Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. This week, a conversation with Mayor Pete Buttigieg about playing Mike Pence during the recent debate preparations for Kamala Harris, his thoughts about President Trump, his thoughts about his new book, which is about trust and how to rebuild that, and his thoughts about Chasten. We had him react to several things that his husband said in our recent interview and some funny moments and some emotional moments, and it really was quite something. And so I hope you enjoy that as much as we did. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking with Jeff Mason, the White House correspondent for Reuters, about this coronavirus outbreak at the West Wing, what it's like behind the scenes there, and what's next for this campaign. But let's begin with the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, former Democratic presidential candidate, and potentially future cabinet member. Here's Pete Buttigieg.
He just wrapped up playing Vice President Mike Pence during debate preparations with California Senator Kamala Harris for the big VP debate. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, welcome back to The Issue Is. Good to see you.
Same here. Thanks for having me back.
All right. So you played Mike Pence behind the scenes. What was it like living inside the head of the vice president?
Well, it's always strange spending that much time getting into the mind of someone you disagree with that much. But I thought it was also an opportunity as somebody who, you know, worked with him during the time, or sometimes against him, during the time that I was mayor and he was governor. I know him well. I know what to expect from him. And I was glad that I could bring that to the team that was helping Senator Harris get ready. And, you know, she did a phenomenal job. And, carrying really the weight of history onto that debate stage. I was really proud of how she, as someone who is, you know, such a significant leader in our time and bringing so much to the ticket. I was thrilled that she was able to get there and penetrate the sort of force field of alternate reality that he likes to create.
Well, speaking of that, the president described Senator Harris as a monster, as a communist. What's your reaction to some of the reaction to her?
Well, you know, it's unfortunately what we've come to expect from this president, but it also doesn't add up. I mean, you have somebody who was throughout her career and certainly throughout this campaign, you know, demonstrating an approach that most Americans agree with. I mean, look, the Biden-Harris platform on issues from making sure the wealthy pay their fair share in taxes to making sure how everybody can get health care to having a better way to deal with this pandemic. It's where most people already are. And that was the disadvantage that Mike Pence had, as smooth of a debater as he is. When he walked onto that stage, he did so disagreeing with the American people on issue after issue. And in particular, the American people know that we deserve better than we've had in this administration's failed response to the pandemic.
You know, there is one question that the Harris team, the Biden team, are just not answering, which is over whether or not to add a Supreme Court justice if the Democrats control the Senate. Why the political calculus not to answer that question? And what do you say to critics who say, you know what, voters deserve to know something like that? It's a pretty important issue.
Well, I think what's going on here is they're trying to make sure that the Republicans are not successful in distracting from the issue in front of us right now. There are all kinds of complex institutional issues facing the court. I've taken an interest in them in a long time. But what's going on right now is, in a matter of days, the Senate could act to install a justice to a lifetime appointment who, a few weeks from now, could be part of a majority that would eliminate pre-existing condition coverage and other vital elements of the Affordable Care Act for all Americans. We are within weeks, potentially, of having a majority on the court willing to overturn marriage equality, at least if the smoke signals from Justice Thomas and Alito tell us anything. And, there's clearly a lot of interest on the Trump-Pence side to get us talking about anything but the future of our own healthcare, anything but what's going on with the pandemic. And, we don't want that kind of distraction to overtake this vitally important, much more immediate, in-your-face, urgent issue that's at stake in this nomination that, again, will be playing out in a matter of days.
Well, because those issues are so important, there are a lot of folks on the left. I mean, in the last couple of weeks on our show, we've interviewed two former senators, Barbara Boxer and Al Franken, who both said that Democrats should strongly consider adding justices to the court because those issues are so important. What do you say?
I mean, I'm more interested in reforms that would just reduce the overall politicization of the court. court. We can't go on like this, where there's an ideological death match every time there's a vacancy on the bench. There are a lot of ways to do that. I discussed many of them in my campaign. My views haven't changed, speaking only for myself. But again, I think we need to make sure that we don't allow some agenda to succeed, distracting us from the very real, immediate, personal consequences of healthcare being stripped away from millions of Americans by a decision that could be made this November.
Speaking of distractions, I one more question about the debate. I know you prepare for everything, but was there a plan during debate prep for a fly landing on the VP's head for 2 minutes? What did you make of that and all the memes that have come from it?
You know, I was one of the last Americans to find out about the fly because we were in the hall and you couldn't see it from where I was sitting. you know, I hope the fly's okay. I don't know if the fly was stuck or if the fly was trying to warn us about something. But it shows you the way things work now. It got a lot of attention, and I saw some rankings that had the winner of the debate as Senator Harris, followed by the fly with the vice president in third place.
All right, let's talk about some others. You've been really busy these days. You're hosting the Deciding Decade podcast, which is really great. You're a great broadcaster. Congratulations on that. And you got a new book as well. Here is that book cover again. It is called Trust. And your main thesis of the book is every aspect of our society is really having a deficit of trust right now. We saw some of that expressed in a really visceral way during some of this year's civil unrest that we saw in streets here in California and all across the country. How do we deal with that?
Well, if you think about the biggest issues facing our country, from racial justice to this pandemic to climate change, these are all issues that are going to require cooperation in order to advance, and it's just not going to happen unless we have greater trust. That means building institutions that are more trustworthy. Look, there are reasons why political trust and social trust have been falling swiftly in America in recent years, and we've got to do something about that. It's why I believe we need lots of institutional reforms to make our society more democratic. Also, more attention to the reasons that this distrust has arisen, especially in the case of racial injustice, where many Americans, especially Black Americans, have every reason to be skeptical and suspicious of institutions, from the criminal legal system to medicine to banks.
I mean, to me, part of the reason we don't have trust right now is we have also a truth crisis in the country. You see this in the presidential race. People living in information echo chambers aren't willing to accept facts that don't fit their particular narratives, sort of do this, don't want to listen to anybody else. How do we get out of that situation?
Well, I think a lot of that comes down to our relationship with the media. The reality is that we're always going to have different interests and different values, but the only way we can have an honest negotiation of those interests and values is if we have the same facts. Now, ironically, the more raw information has become available to us through things like digital media, the more we need journalists to help us sort fact from fiction, and to be transparent about when we're hearing an opinion and when we're hearing straight fact or coverage. And it's not just up to the media. Frankly, we as citizens, as consumers of media, need to get a little more savvy about digital information, the same way over time humans learn to be a little smarter about what comes to us in print media. And as the saying goes, not believe everything we read.
And on that theme of sort of not listening to each other, you're in an interesting position. You know, we're in a blue state here in California. You're in a red state in Indiana. There are a lot of folks that voted for you for mayor and voted for Donald Trump for president as well. Help some of the folks that live in a blue state like California understand what's going on in those people's lives where they support President Trump.
Look, where I live, there are a lot of folks who just felt like Democrats hadn't really spoken to them in a long time. And, you know, this president, even though I think it was in a total bad faith, this president did a good job of making some people feel seen and really speaking to this kind of sense of grievance that's built up. Now, the really ironic thing is this president does not care about working people. You can see in his economic policies how tilted they are toward the wealthiest and toward corporations. But I will say messages like his do find more fertile ground in societies where there's a lot of inequality. And so we've got to deal with the root causes that make it possible for people like him to get as far as they do. That means making sure we deal with the inequality, social and economic, that we're living with. And you know, we should give absolutely no quarter to the kind of racism that he benefited from in his campaign. At the same time, understand that he's not an anomaly. He reflects something broader that's gone wrong in the American condition. And it's one of the reasons I consider it so important for Democrats to be anywhere and everywhere, to be campaigning in red states and rural counties. It's one of the reasons I go on conservative television just as often as I go on with television hosts whose ideology is a little closer to mine. Not because I think I'm going to convince everybody, but because I know there are a lot of people who tune in to these media sources in good faith. And I can't blame them for not understanding our message if they've literally never heard it. That's why I got to go out there and offer it directly to people who just might open up their minds a little bit if they hear from us more often.
And you do that probably more than any of your Democratic colleagues. And a lot of those clips were trending just this week of you doing just that. Okay. In the spirit of trust, in the spirit of honesty, a lot of folks think that you're going to be a potential cabinet pick in the Biden administration. Which cabinet post do you want the most?
I'm not going to get out of my head. I see what you're trying to do there, but we're not going to get ahead of ourselves. Look, the most important thing I can do right now is make sure there actually is a Biden-Harris administration. And then once there is, I'll do everything I can to support it. And if that means a chance to return to public service and support from within, that's great. And if I'll be doing it from the outside, that works too. I just want to make sure that we have a Biden-Harris administration to lead us out of this mess, to restore the soul of the nation, as Joe Biden likes to say. And then I'll do everything I can to help one way or the other.
Okay, can't blame a brother for trying. All right, we also want to have a little bit of fun. let's stroll down memory lane a bit. Please welcome Pete Buttigieg. The last time we talked to Mayor Pete Buttigieg, we were at USC in front of nearly 2,000 students. Now we're talking via Skype. He's in his kitchen. This event here feels like a million years ago. It was in February. We had a lighter moment then when we were talking, when we asked who should play you in a movie. And Jimmy Fallon, apparently he's a big fan of The Issue Is, happened to be watching our show. Take a look.
You know, I was just thinking about you because you came up in the news recently by Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And let me show you this clip really quick.
Who would play you in a biopic?
I'm hoping for John Mulaney.
Oh, okay. I can see that.
I was like, yo!
I mean,
would you?
I'm hoping for, like, I've been offered two movies and I am in both of them. And
so he's in, right? Pretty cool.
That's great. Sounds like a deal.
Yeah. Fun question. Here's a fun question.
To actually do it.
Yeah. Here's a fun question from producer Nick Greitzer. If John Mulaney plays you in the movie, who plays your husband, Chasten, in the movie?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going to have to ask him so I don't get the wrong answer and get in trouble. But that would probably be the more interesting part to play.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of Chasten, you're famously a huge Star Trek The Next Generation fan, as am I. You even got to interview Captain Picard himself, Patrick Stewart, while you were guest hosting Jimmy Kimmel Live, which I was so jealous of. So we recently had Chasten on our show, and I think he was sitting in that same exact spot. And I was shocked at his answer to this question. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Neither.
Star Trek or Star Wars, neither? That's your answer? Well, because I saw it.
I was watching Harry Potter movies. I'm sorry. Yeah. I was never sorry.
How do you marry somebody like that?
As a spouse. I haven't given up. I got him fairly interested in the new Picard series, so we're making tracks. But clearly, I've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Well, when you were in Kimmel, you showed yourself dressed as Captain Picard for Halloween at a very young age, and I think I dressed in the very same costume at the very same time. Here's a picture of that.
Wow.
So, I'll just say, some would say that
hey,
we're dorks.
Think alike.
Yeah, some would say we're dorks. I say we have great taste. Let's go with that.
Absolutely.
Something else that was I think really touching and really moving when we talked with Chasten recently. We talked to him about his book. Congratulations to him on that. And what you mean to him. Here's what he said.
The thing I love about Pete is he made me feel so seen. And so loved and comfortable being myself. I mean, he took a wrecking ball to that wall I built up between my heart and the rest of the world. And to feel truly loved like that, to feel understood and cherished for who you are, that is the greatest gift of all. So, I mean, he means the world to me.
What's your reaction to that, and what does he mean to you?
He means the world to me. And, you know, I think I know I'm a better person because he's in my life. When I say that he's the best thing that happened to me, that's morally as well as in a lot of other ways. He helps me see things I would never see otherwise. And I don't know what I did to be lucky enough to have him in my life, but he's the best.
And to bring things full circle, in the book Trust, it's dedicated for Chasten, whose trust changed my life. Congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the podcast. Congratulations on the marriage. Congratulations on everything. Thank you for being here.
Our thanks to Mayor Pete. Now, a conversation with Jeff Mason, the White House correspondent for Reuters, longtime in that job, served in the Obama White House as the White House correspondent for Reuters, too, as the former president of the White House Correspondents Association. He breaks down what it's like at the White House at a time unlike any in American history.
Good to be with you, Alex.
All right. So there were some that thought maybe if the president gets coronavirus and goes to the hospital, his feeling about it, his feeling about masks, his feeling about restrictions or regulations might change. But in reality, it seems like he's doubling down to the way that he thought before it, trying to still sort of downplay COVID-19, scheduling more rallies, taking off his mask. What's the political calculus in his mind when it comes to that?
Well, I think you're spot on in saying that. It's been interesting watching him since he got diagnosed with COVID-19. He has, of course, continually downplayed the virus since the beginning of the pandemic at the beginning of this year, and he's continued to do it since he got it, despite the fact that he has also said in recent days this week that it was pretty serious for him when he first came down with the virus. But I think Donald Trump is somebody who doesn't like to move away from a position that he has already articulated, and his position on masking has been pretty clear from the beginning. Even though he says he supports it, he very rarely wears one himself. And as you mentioned, when he got back from the hospital, he ripped it off, and that was a symbolic gesture that epitomizes his view largely about the virus and about the guidance about how to prevent the virus from spreading.
You know, I first met you when the president came to California. I was part of the White House press pool for a day, and I was surprised that they required all of the reporters to wear masks. That was the White House press team that asked that. But most of the folks around were not wearing masks, including Hope Hicks, who ended up getting COVID-19. Have the rules changed? Have the protocols changed? And can you take us a little bit behind the scenes of what's it like working at the White House in the midst of so many folks there getting infected?
Sure. Well, it's interesting to me that they told you that you needed to wear a mask then, because the rules that we've been following in the White House press corps have not been rules dictated by the White House. They've been really guidance from the CDC and from the White House Correspondents Association, which is the group of reporters at the White House. So we've been wearing masks. Reporters at the White House have been wearing masks for months. White House officials have not. And you know, it's just that became very clear in the last week when an outbreak within the White House really, really took off. Not only the President of the United States, but lots and lots of staffers as well at the highest levels of the White House and of his campaign. In terms of being sort of behind the scenes, Alex, I can tell you that there has been a change in the last week being inside the White House. Number one, there are fewer people there. It's almost like a ghost town, because so many people were exposed and have been affected by this outbreak. But number two, the people who are coming to work in person at the White House, in addition to the reporters like myself, have started wearing masks inside their offices. And that was not the case before this outbreak and before the president got COVID himself.
Now, you have an interesting perspective because you're not only covering President Trump, but you've also been out on the road covering Joe Biden. Talk to us about some of the biggest differences between those two experiences and what it's like going to a Joe Biden event compared to going to a President Trump event.
Yeah, it's interesting. I covered Joe Biden when he was vice president, the 8 years that President Obama was in office, but I hadn't been out with him during this campaign. So it was instructive to see him out on the trail. He hasn't traveled a lot in the last several months because of the pandemic, but he has stepped up that travel. And I was on his trip to Miami. I was on a trip to Michigan. And he wears a mask. In fact, when he was in Florida, he wore a mask throughout his speech, which is a shift even from his previous speeches. That was an adjustment, I think, after the president got the coronavirus. The events themselves are socially distant. There are far fewer people there. Covering President Trump during this campaign has been a little bit as if the pandemic weren't happening. You go to rallies, there are thousands and thousands of people. I've been to both indoor and outdoor rallies with him in the last few months, including in Las Vegas and elsewhere in the country, where people just aren't socially distant and aren't wearing masks. Some people are. Some people wear them. But it's definitely the exception and not the rule. Whereas with the Biden campaign, it was definitely the rule.
You know, most polls seem to indicate that Joe Biden's got a healthy lead right now in most swing states and a big lead nationally. That means the Trump campaign really could use another debate to try to change the narrative. This week, the president says, I don't want to do a virtual debate. And then Joe Biden says, fine, I'll schedule something else. I got a town hall. I'm out. I mean, did the Biden campaign sort of call the bluff of the president there? And where do you see the future of debates going?
Well, that second question is a good one. The one debate that we had between the president and Vice President Biden was such a chaotic affair that I think it raised questions like that one you posed about the future of debates. The fact that President Trump decided he didn't want to participate in a virtual debate in some ways was a gift to Vice President Biden because, as you said, he is now holding his own event. I suspect President Trump will hold his own event that night, too. But those events, whether it's a town hall or a rally, won't get the same eyeballs, the same viewers that a nationally televised debate would have. And right now, it's the person who's behind President Trump who really needs those eyeballs. So that may be advantage Biden. There will still be one more debate towards the end of the month. And at that point, the president should be free of the virus based on the progress that he's made in the last week. But the debate commission didn't want to take a risk on doing it next week. And that was something the Biden campaign supported and the Trump campaign did not.
Yeah, I mean, a Trump rally could probably air on Fox News Channel, get maybe 3 or 4 million viewers. A debate in prime time between the two of them could get 60, 70, 80 million viewers. So big difference there when you're trying to reach out beyond your base as well, as you mentioned. Okay, so much of reporting is about the story, but we don't get to hear a lot about you. So we see you in the briefing room, but we want to get to know you a little bit better. So we play a game called Personal Issues on this show. This is where we put 30 seconds up on the clock and we get to know a little bit more about you. Okay, you ready?
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, what's your favorite meal to cook?
Salmon.
Any new skills you've learned during quarantine?
I have to say, apropos cooking, I'm cooking a little bit more.
What is your favorite book?
The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen.
What's your favorite band?
Guster.
What is your favorite show to binge?
I'm going to have to go with Ozark.
Good one. Love Netflix. And finally, who is your role model?
My grandparents.
Very nice. Why is that?
Oh, I was really lucky growing up. I had all four grandparents for most of my life. And my grandmother on the maternal side is 103 and still living.
Wow.
It's been pretty awesome.
They're very lucky on that front.
Thank you to Jeff and to Pete Buttigieg and to you for listening. Next week on The Issue Is, Katie Kirk is going to be with us, plus a special Issue Is congressional debate. Thanks for listening. Please tell other people about us, rate us, subscribe, and connect with me on social media at Alex Michelson, ELEXMICHAELSON. See you next time for more of The Issue Is.